Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. All the focus on the Trump travel ban has practically hidden the fact that one of those seven countries, Yemen, has now become the scene of Donald Trump's first military action, and he may be about to order a new troop surge in Afghanistan. The raid in Yemen on January 28th left one U.S. Navy SEAL and multiple civilians dead. William Ryan Owens, we should say his name out loud, became the first military fatality on President Trump's watch. Yemen and Afghanistan both may give us the first real signs of what kind of war President Trump intends to be after an erratic campaign in which he called for America First isolationism, but also said he would destroy ISIS. Let's see what's happening. We have two great guests, John Finer, who was chief of staff for Secretary of State John Kerry. Before that, he reported from the Washington Post from more than 20 countries, and current Washington Post correspondent Thomas Gibbons Neff, who's been reporting on the Yemen situation. He himself was twice deployed to Afghanistan when he was in the Marines from 2007 to 2011. John and Thomas, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
And Thomas, for people who haven't been following the story, can you explain the basics of the January 28th raid and why the president ordered it?
Right, absolutely. So the January 28th raid in Yemen was in southwestern Yemen in a village called Yakala. And basically it was a holdover part of a plan that was kind of ginned up under the Obama administration in the last few months as an extension of a counterterrorism campaign against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula that is based primarily in Yemen. So the plan kind of came up through the channels in the tail end of the Obama administration and then was passed over to Trump when he came into office. And basically it was a nighttime covert operation run by Navy SEALs, SEAL Team 6, and troops with the from the UAE. The Emirati commandos, Navy SEALs, went in under cover of darkness to hit a village, a cluster of houses to gather intelligence, whether that would be from computers or documents or even, you know, some maybe mid-level al-Qaeda commanders, and basically would gather that intelligence, bring it back, and help them continue targeting al-Qaeda militants. But what happened was a massive firefight broke out when the SEALs encountered resistance from pretty much the entire village, and not to mention that the village was heavily mined on the outskirts. So with that, there were casualties, and whenever there's casualties during a mission of that type, you know, that creates friction. And that friction can lead to a number of things. And basically what happened, they got the casualties out. And as they were going to link up with the Marine Quick Reaction Force that was going to move those casualties back to ships floating offshore so they could be treated, one of the Marine helicopters or a tilt rotor Osprey came down in a hard landing and had to be destroyed. So that's pretty much the gist of it.
You said that they took fire from almost the entire village. Is that to say that that village supports their al-Qaeda leaders?
Well, al-Qaeda kind of thrives within the populace, I mean, in these areas. So in this case, yes. I mean, there were al-Qaeda leaders there. There were fighters. There were the fighters' families. And, you know, from reports from the Pentagon, you know, that some of the women who were in the village also took up arms. I mean, this is a kind of a rural area. Kind of imagine that every house has maybe a Kalashnikov. So those Kalashnikovs came off the mantles, per se, and engaged the SEALs.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We're in New York and New Jersey public radio as we talk about the first instances of President Trump as a war president with John Finer, who is chief of staff for Secretary of State John Kerry, and Washington Post correspondent Thomas Gibbons Neff. And we can take phone calls for them at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9696. 9-2. John, as the chief of staff for Secretary of State Kerry until just before Trump took office, would that raid have been consistent with what the Obama administration would have been likely to do in Yemen, or more of a departure from it? I understand that it was under development already in some form when Obama was still president.
That's right. It was consistent with an overall approach and policy direction that the administration was moving towards. But what I think is also important is that this specific operation was not approved or heavily vetted by the Obama administration before we left office. What we basically decided to do was leave this sort of operational decision and all of the analysis that should go along with making a decision like this to put troops into harm's way to the next administration, because of because of the timeline that was developing, it was likely to take place on their watch. So we believe that they should be the ones to actually do the analysis and make the decision.
And John, what's the big picture in Yemen? Why is the U.S. military engaged there at all, and with what goals?
Well, I think what's important to understand about the conflict that's taking place in Yemen is that there really are two distinct wars that have some overlapping features. One is the conflict of which this raid is a part that has been going on since, frankly, several years now, well before even the Arab Spring, which is a counterterrorism fight that the Yemeni government is engaged with and that the United States has been supporting against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is, by most accounts, the most virulent strain of the al-Qaeda organization, and one that has both demonstrated a willingness and an ability to try to attack American partners and even the American homeland. The other is a more recent conflict that has been waged really since the end of 2014, the beginning of 2015. An uprising by a group called an ethnic group called the Houthis in the north of Yemen that decided to take on the Yemeni government, came into Sana'a on force, en masse in late 2014, early 2015, and actually pushed the government that we were working with aside. That government then fled to southern Yemen. The Houthis continue to occupy the capital, and there's been an ongoing fight between the government of Yemen, which, again, has basically been exiled, the Houthis, who now control broad swaths of Yemeni territory, and an intervention by foreign forces, primarily Saudi Arabia, on the side of the government of Yemen. And the United States is supporting that coalition, the Saudi government, the government of Yemen, in their fight against the Houthis. So these are really two different conflicts taking place in more or less certainly the same country and in some cases the same battle space.
And, Thomas, I see the U.S. moved a Navy destroyer, the USS Cole, which of course itself in the 90s was attacked by al-Qaeda, but the Cole off the coast of Yemen last week after Iran-backed rebels attacked a Saudi warship. How much is Yemen a proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia for dominance in the region?
I mean, that's kind of hard to say as far as, you know, again, as you have the civil war between the Houthis and the Yemeni government. You have the AQAP in Yemen that we're kind of dealing with. But as far as what the Saudis see the Iranian-backed Houthis as definitely a proxy war. And again, you know, we're backing up the Saudis and in kind of the limited way that we are now with intelligence and refueling. And I mean, it's going to be up to the Trump administration to see how much they want to decide how much that is going to be an actual proxy war.
What's your understanding of the reason for the deployment of the Cole there? Why seem to threaten further U.S. military involvement in a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, if that's what it is?
I mean, we're protecting our allies. You know, this isn't the first time that we've sent destroyers into that region called the Mandib Strait. It's a valuable shipping lane, and just in the past, in October, our destroyers were targeted by Houthi shore-fired missiles, and the U.S. retaliated with a Tomahawk cruise missile strike on three radar sites.
John, similar question. Is that ship deployment consistent with what you would have done under Secretary Kerry and President Obama? Is there the beginning of some kind of Trump doctrine of foreign policy and use of the military here, or anything that would have been a departure in sending the coal off the coast of Yemen?
So I think the only reasonable answer at this point is that it's too soon to tell. The ship deployment in and of itself is not particularly, as Thomas said, inconsistent with the steps that have been taken in the past, particularly to help secure what is a very heavily trafficked and vital shipping lane that seems to be increasingly under threat. What I think is the bigger question, frankly, is what is the strategy and what are the priorities for the new administration going to be for Yemen with regard to these two conflicts? Are they planning to keep the U.S. Force commitment focused on the counterterrorism fight against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which, again, has a direct connection both to U.S. Security and U.S. interests? Or are they increasingly going to venture into the other conflict in a deeper way, into the civil war? Now, that raises all kinds of questions. If actually the second conflict is more their intention, they have signaled a desire to quote-unquote push back against Iranian meddling in the region, which, again, in and of itself is not a concern. But the question becomes, what does that exactly look like? Because the reality is, the more deeply involved we get into that civil conflict, the more likely a situation like U.S. Forces being directly engaged, potentially even with Iranian forces, becomes a possibility, and the potential for that to escalate in a scenario where the new administration does not really have the types of relationships with the Iranian government that we had to be able to de-escalate potential conflict, has the potential to really spiral in ways that could be unhelpful.
Take us further down that road. Do you think that the Trump administration, Trump himself, maybe through more belligerent rhetoric against Iran or the new sanctions against Iran for the ballistic missile test, worsen relations with a country with which we already have hostile relations, and that was true during Obama and for years and years and years, in some kind of way that you think is unwise?
That's the risk. The risk is that this, I think a well-intentioned desire to stand up against Iranian troublemaking in the region, which is a very real thing, quickly goes beyond what is intended and spirals and escalates in ways that could lead to conflict that neither side particularly wants. And this is why, at the end of the Obama administration, at least at the State Department, our primary focus in terms of Yemen policy was trying to end the civil war, the war between the Houthis and the Yemeni government that I described earlier. We believe that conflict is no longer really in anyone's interest to continue waging, including our close partners, the Saudis, who have expressed a desire for it to be over. We also believe there's no military way in which that conflict is going to be ended. We don't think the coalition is going to achieve a military victory. We don't think the Houthis can achieve anything close to a military victory. They're a small minority of the country and can never really govern Yemen themselves.
Huh.
Therefore,
can jump in, that would suggest that maybe the Obama administration would not have ordered this raid in which a Navy SEAL died at all, because you were concluding that there was no military solution in Yemen.
No, again, so I want to be clear, because I think now I don't want you to confuse these two conflicts. That military raid is part of the counterterrorism war against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So a separate and apart from the peacemaking that we have been trying to do between, again, the Saudis and the Yemeni government and the Houthis, which is a separate conflict
entirely.
I see.
So you're separating. Yeah. So to make it as clear as we can for the listeners, you're separating this kind of civil war in Yemen from Yemen as a base for al-Qaeda leaders who were planning international terrorism attacks.
That's exactly right. And, part of the problem, though, with the raid, and if you want to really analyze what went on there, I mean, I think there are a few big questions about that. The process through which decisions are being made in this new administration is one that I think justifiably has gotten a lot of scrutiny. The reports say that this decision was made over dinner with just a few members of the president's cabinet present, not including someone from the Department of State, not including someone from the intelligence community who could have provided a bit more context about kind of the possible implications of all this. I think it's those factors and the way in which this decision came about that has given people pause less, more so than the decision itself.
If you're just joining us, folks, my guest, as we talk about the first days of Trump as a war president, our Washington Post correspondent, Thomas Gibbons Neff, who's been reporting on the Yemen situation. He himself was twice deployed to Afghanistan when he was in the Marines. And John Finer, who was the chief of staff for Secretary of State John Kerry. And we can take your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And I think Sally in Riverside, Connecticut, has a question relevant to what John was just saying. Sally, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. My question is back to the raid. And I told the screener that, you know, we see in the movies the Situation Room where the president, the military staff, and it's, you know, Secretary of State. And I know these guys, you know, come in that, you know, death. Can't know for sure, but do you think Trump was in a Situation Room, you know, making real-time decisions, watching this raid as it was developing?
John, I'll give that one to you.
So, you know, I have no special insight into what he was doing during the time of the raid itself. It won't surprise you to hear they don't exactly consult with us about these things. What I will say is it would not be unusual for the president himself not to be sort of watching and monitoring something like this in real time. You know, his team very well might have been doing that, but whether or not he was, which I don't know the answer to, it would not necessarily be unusual for the president himself to just be briefed on the outcome afterwards as opposed to, you know, directly monitoring himself.
What listeners may be more familiar with in the news on this is the back and forth between Trump and John McCain over whether to call the raid a success. Here's McCain.
My understanding of the parameters of the raid were that they wanted to capture individuals, and obviously they didn't want to kill children or women. I don't think you can, when you lose a $75 million airplane, and more importantly, American lives are life is lost and wounded, I don't believe that you can call it a success.
Now here's White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer reacting to McCain.
It's absolutely a success. And I think anyone who would suggest it's not a success does disservice to the life of Chief Ryan Owens.
And here's McCain reacting back.
Many years ago when I was in prison in North Vietnam, there was an attempt to rescue the POWs. Unfortunately, the prison had been evacuated. But the brave men who partook on that mission and risked their lives in an effort to rescue us prisoners of war were genuine American heroes. Because the mission failed, did not in any way diminish their bravery and courage and a willingness to sacrifice for their fellow Americans who were being held captive. Mr. Spicer should know that story.
So, Thomas from the Washington Post, what's your reporter's take on how much a success, how much a failure? And I wonder if you have a human take, a personal take, as somebody who was a Marine in the Afghanistan war, just about the whole exchange.
Yeah, I mean, that exchange definitely stood out to me in a lot of ways, and from the reporter side, right? I mean, there was a loss of life. Chief Owens was killed. SEALs were wounded. An aircraft was destroyed. And then on the other side, you have the Pentagon saying, yes, we gathered intelligence. It's actionable. It'll lead us to other Al-Qaeda targets. So, I mean, putting in these two boxes of success and failure has kind of turned into just a political ploy to, you know, for whatever side deems it viable for whatever day of the week it is. I mean, and then on the personal side, you know, I think that, again, I think by saying you can't question or can't criticize or can't look at something critically and by doing that you are, you know, disservicing the memory of someone who died, I think that's kind of unfair. I mean, just speaking from experience, you know, I look at the war in Afghanistan very critically. I lost a number of friends, and I don't think that cheapens what they did and what they fought for.
Let's take a phone call, another phone call. Richard in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Hi. When I first heard about this raid, first of all, it wasn't to interact with any of the people. It was to get computer information mostly. But the main thing is it was planned during the new moon, and there would be no moonlight to illuminate the moving figures on a very flat surface, flat ground. But they did it when there was moonlight, and they were spotted, and the whole town tossed them out.
They did it before the full moon, you're saying. I think he's asking you, Thomas, if this raid was rushed, if it was supposed to take place around now and it was rushed up to last week for any reason when there was less moonlight.
Right. So the issue of there being a no moonlight. So the raid took place when there was it was called 1% illumination, so there was no moon. And that was announced by White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. And during our reporting, we were kind of cautioned to not use that detail because it's a technique that maybe the Pentagon didn't want out there. That being said, you know, as far as the timetable, I don't think it was rushed. It doesn't seem rushed. I mean, the plan, you know, how the decision was made, you know, at the dinner where Trump was present versus, you know, the type of planning that went into, you know, quote unquote, the concept of operations, whether it be, you know, what units were going to be used or what air support was going to be on standby, if there was going to be something there to help the commandos out if they came under heavy attack. I mean, I think that was extremely well planned and orchestrated.
John, we've got you back now. Can you hear us? I think we lost John Feiner's line for just a second. We'll get him back, but we still have Thomas from the Washington Post, and we have Judith in Winter Haven, Florida, calling in. Judith, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Question, and maybe I missed it, because I did see the interviews with John Kerry on PBS during the, you know, the period between November and January, and he was waiting for the phone call. Was there an orderly transition? I never got the information as a consumer as to whether or not, you know, the Trump administration even reached out to John Kerry and met with him and did do the debriefing. I mean, all these, you know, we're only a month into this administration, and it seems like there's so many foreign policy mistakes. What happened there? Did Trump reach out to Kerry and get the information he needed to do his job properly?
Judith, thank you. And let's see if we have John Feiner, who was Kerry's chief of staff, back on the line. I think we had a line problem. John, you there?
I am. Sorry about that.
Could you hear Judith's question?
I did not hear the most recent question, no.
She was asking about whether the Trump people ever really took good transition briefings from Secretary of State Kerry.
Yeah, it's a good question. I can only speak for the State Department. There were different transition groups that went around to the different departments and agencies, including to the White House. Secretary Kerry spoke once on the phone with Secretary-designate at the time, Tillerson. It was not a particularly substantive conversation, although it was perfectly professional and cordial. After that, they did not meet again. You know, I think many of us in senior positions at the State Department had prepared for months sort of memos and information that we thought would be important for the new team to have when they came in, including, you know, upcoming dates on the calendar, a bit of information about important aspects of our jobs. The vast majority of us, I would say almost all of us, never actually met with the people who were coming in to fill those positions, or even in many cases knew the names of who was going to be filling those positions by the time that we left. So, you know, I would say that it was a transition that we prepared for. You know, our direction from the White House and from our boss, Secretary Kerry, was to do everything possible to make it as smooth and to be as helpful as we could. But in the end, there was very little actual connectivity that was established with the new group.
Jason in West New York, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jason.
Yeah, I just wanted a question of who was in the room at the dining room table that we can confirm was there that helped make the decision. I think those people should know that they now know the full seriousness of the kind of decisions that they're involved in making or hurting, you know, the president toward making. And if they're not qualified and they were not qualified, then they should have stepped out of the room. That's one thing. I'm a former Army captain, and I can understand the weight of some kind of decision like that. And I'd also like to say, you know, to the amateurish response by Sean Spicer and the administration in terms of the placing success or failure on an operation like this. Operations like this, things happen. It's how you deal with it that what's happened. And I think the more recent example that we could point to that at least, you know, the military that I served in the 90s learned from was the Somali operation. No one would ever, ever say that the Rangers that gave their lives and the Delta Force operators that gave their lives in that failed raid. And it was considered a failure by all. To ever be anything other than the most honorable heroes that gave everything on that day. And it's an insult to anybody that serves in uniform to take the mistakes from operations like this and learn from them, right? To use it to over-politicize back and forth, especially with a guy like John McCain, who has served, who didn't serve, who didn't dodge the draft to get there. And I'm sorry, I get a little emotional, but that's my response.
Jason, thank you. I really appreciate your call. Thomas, do you get the sense that the Trump administration is trying to call a raid that was clearly a failure, a success, because they don't want anything to be labeled a failure, and that's just kind of the way Trump is. That just does seem to be the way Trump is about so many things. Or were there elements of this raid that can be deemed a success?
Well, as far as the latter part of that question, I mean, we don't know. I mean, the Pentagon and Central Command and everyone I've talked to said, you know, stuff that was taken from the raid will be helpful in future operations. That is yet to be seen. You know, as far as the first part of the question about, you know, Trump labeling things winning, I mean, yeah, this is obviously consistent. I mean, you saw, I think he had a series of tweets yesterday where he called it a winning raid, which is a phrase I don't really understand. So, you know, again, it goes back to putting things in neat boxes. And as the caller just mentioned, you know, things happen on the objective. There, people were killed. Civilians were killed. I mean, something we haven't really talked about, you know, upwards of 20 civilians were shot and bombed because, again, this was a kinetic operation and things definitely went sideways.
And another aspect of this that's unclear to me, and Thomas, maybe you can clear it up, is that there was a report that because of the civilian casualties in this raid, that Yemen said it's suspending its cooperation with the U.S. in the U.S.'s attempts to get al-Qaeda leaders who are based in Yemen. But now I hear that may not be the case. Can you unpack that?
Right. Yeah, so that was two nights ago, the New York Times came out with a report saying that Yemen had banned ground missions, ground counterterror missions of the like that this January 28th raid was. And then the next day, the Yemeni foreign minister came out on the record and said, no, we're not. It's not a ban. We're just reviewing or assessing the raid. So, you know, the New York Times didn't walk back their reporting, which kind of says to me that, you know, there was probably someone said something and something did come down the pipe. And then, you know, fearing political backlash from the Trump administration, the Yemeni government officially kind of walked it back to the middle. But what that does say is that, you know, this has been a very polarizing operation in Yemen. And, you know, just talking to our correspondent who based out of Cairo, who has done a lot of reporting there, is that this has really unified Yemenis against the U.S. I mean, these civilians, the names have been broadcasted all around Yemeni media. Their pictures have been online of people who were killed. So, I mean, going forward, I mean, it's definitely going to add an extra layer of friction if we're going to want to keep doing these raids. And I think John probably has good thoughts on that.
And John, I'm curious how this raid and the larger military situation in Yemen inform why Yemen is on the 7-country list in the proposed travel ban. Is there a relationship between the two? And hearing about these 20 civilian deaths, for example, are we creating any refugees with our military involvement with Yemen?
So, Brian, first, I just wanted to respond on the, you know, on the back and forth quickly between President Trump, and actually really with Mr. Spicer and John McCain.
Sure.
You know, it won't surprise you, I think, to hear that I line up with Senator McCain on this. And I do think it's an important question of whether, you know, every military operation, regardless of the outcome, has to be called a success or else you're diminishing, you know, the heroism of the people involved. But I also think there's a pattern emerging every time the new administration, particularly the president, comments on an area of policy in a you know, sort of provocative way. We end up focusing very heavily on the comment and less heavily on the substance, which is why I'm glad to be on a program like this where you're really trying to dig into what's actually happening in Yemen. It ends up becoming, though, a big distraction from what they're actually doing and avoids them having to answer hard questions about what their approach to these problems is actually going to be. So I think it's important that people recognize that. We're seeing it on Iran. We certainly saw it on the refugee and immigrant ban that they imposed, and the question became really about their rhetoric more than about the impact to some extent. In terms of, you know, whether this explains why Yemen was included as one of the 7 countries as part of the executive order that's now been stayed by courts out west, you know, I think the terrorism problem in Yemen goes some way towards explaining, you know, why Yemen would be included on a list like this. You know, the new administration, I think, would have to explain the rationale for including them. Yemen is certainly a country that we, you know, worried a lot about and looked very closely at for all kinds of purposes when we were still in office. If you are going to draw up a list like this, I don't think including Yemen is fundamentally irrational. The question is toward what purpose? We never, ever contemplated barring all immigration or all refugee resettlement from any countries, let alone from seven countries the way this new administration has, even though they've tried to tie what they've done to steps that we took. You know, that's just – there's no reality in this. And in terms of whether we are creating, you know, a new refugee problem, there's a pretty serious refugee problem in Yemen. There's actually a massively – overlooked and grave humanitarian crisis going on in Yemen right now. I think, but for Syria, it's probably the worst anywhere on the planet. And because this is somewhat far away and a relatively obscure conflict, doesn't get the attention it deserves, other than from journalists like Thomas and his colleagues who are focused on it. You know, I think people tend to overlook that, which is another reason why I think ending that first civil war should be a priority for the new administration.
So, John, as Secretary of State Kerry's former chief of staff, maybe you can clarify one of the things in the travel ban debate that I think is really, really important. One of Trump's arguments for it is that President Obama signed a bill requiring visas for anyone who had been in the visa waiver program who traveled from these seven countries. And Obama people, including yourself, keep saying it's not the same thing. But can you explain why your administration went as far as it did and what the concerns were that led to even that much of a visa crackdown?
Sure. So the new administration has made a bunch of claims that just on this question that just don't add up when you actually look at the facts. First thing they said was that the Obama administration barred Iraqi refugee and special immigrant visa admissions for as long as 6 months back in 2011. We went back and looked at this. It's actually not true. We reviewed the program. We looked for ways to tighten the security vetting. But every single month during that six-month period, there was a significant number of Iraqis who continued to come into the country. So the notion that we barred people is just not true. Then they said the way they got this list of seven countries was that they took it directly from a list of countries put together by Congress and the Obama administration. And so they used that to sort of justify where this list came from. But I think the context here is very important. We put together that list with Congress in the context of what is called the Visa Waiver Program. What the Visa Waiver Program does is give citizens from 38, roughly, I think, European and a few other countries the right to travel to the United States without a visa, and the right for Americans to travel to those countries reciprocally without a visa. What we did was, for those seven countries, anybody who was a dual national of one of the visa waiver program countries and one of those seven countries, or anyone who had traveled to one of those seven countries, was no longer allowed to come to the United States visa-free. Doesn't mean they were no longer allowed to come to the United States. They just had to go through the visa process like everyone else. So instead of relatively instantaneous approval to come to the United States, they had to wait a couple days while their visa was processed, maybe go in for an interview.
Did that allow them to be vetted in a significant way?
It allowed them to go through an additional stage of vetting, but not in any way a bar. In fact, usually the delay was something like a couple of days before they were allowed to eventually travel to the United States.
If it was as pro forma a process as you're making it sound like, why bother to list those seven countries in particular anyway?
I'm not suggesting it's a pro forma process. I'm suggesting the intent was not to bar. The intent was to look more closely at these people, and they were, you know, the vast majority of them eventually were granted, would eventually be granted visas.
All right. We have a few minutes left, and I want to touch very briefly on Afghanistan and Syria. Here is Press Secretary Sean Spicer yesterday answering a reporter's question about a report that President Trump will accept a Pentagon request for more troops for Afghanistan.
I think the president will heed the advice of the generals and Secretary Mattis. That conversation has yet to happen, and if we have any further announcements. But I think that's right now a Department of Defense issue that you should touch base with.
So, Thomas, this one for you. As a Washington Post reporter and former Marine in Afghanistan, can you explain the situation today, more than 15 years after we first went to war there, and why the Pentagon might want more troops at this point?
Sure. So, I mean, we have about 8,400 troops, U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and about somewhere around 9,000, anywhere between 9,000 to 12,000 NATO troops. It might be a little squishy on that number, but basically, you know, from the height of the surge in 2010, 2011, where we had over 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, we've kind of shrunk and are advising the Afghan Afghan forces at a higher level, at the core level. So we're, you know, we have bunches of American advisors and NATO advisors advising the highest echelon of military units in Afghanistan. And basically what has happened is that these Afghan troops that are out kind of in territory where we used to have a lot of U.S. troops and NATO troops have been kind of beaten back into their into the more built-up areas, into the quote-unquote cities. And over the last couple of years, really since combat operations officially ended in November of 2014, the Afghans have taken massive amount of casualties. They have kind of widespread corruption in their armed forces. General Nicholson yesterday talked about ghost soldiers, basically ghost enrollment numbers in the Afghan army is something they need to crack down on. And, you know, as you said, it's a stalemate, and that's kind of, I think, a optimistic way of looking at it. I mean, the Taliban have autonomy in a swaths of the country. The Helmand province, which is kind of their home turf, is pretty much entirely theirs, minus the provincial capital of Lashkargah. And so basically, General Nicholson wants more troops so he can push those advisors down to lower levels, so to basically buffet the Afghan soldiers kind of fighting the fight on the ground instead of just maybe advising their higher-ups.
But what I don't understand about that is if we're only interested now in U.S. national security from terrorists and no longer in nation-building in Afghanistan, why any kind of troop search?
I mean, that's a good question. It's 15 years of endless war over there, and it's kind of gone through all these stages from first being a counterterror mission to a nation-building mission. And there is a counterterrorism mission there. I mean, that was one thing that General Nicholson said was pretty much fine, that he had enough troops to take care of that and could surge in. But as far as keeping the Afghan government propped up and their troops propped up, that he needs more troops. And, you know, if you could maybe make the argument that those two are linked, that without the Afghan government, the counterterror mission gets a lot more complicated.
You would have to make that argument.
I don't.
And, John, one last question about Syria and the refugee ban. The Syrian refugee ban, if it eventually gets approved by the courts, is supposed to be in conjunction with a military mission, we're hearing, to establish a safe zone in Syria that Syrians could go to and not have to leave the country so much and become refugees. What would that involve militarily, in your opinion, and is that something that you considered with Secretary Kerry?
So the concept of a safe zone or a no-fly zone, I mean, people use different terms and often mean different things when they use these. But these are concepts that were looked at extensively by the Obama administration over a period of many years, starting even, frankly, before Secretary Kerry became secretary, but certainly continuing in his time. What I will say is that these questions are often more complicated than they seem and involve a greater degree of force and resource commitments on the part of the country.
That's really my main question, and we just have like half a minute left. But how much American force do you think it would take to create a meaningful safe zone in Syria?
So the key aspect of a safe zone is it has to be safe, and that means there have to be troops on the ground policing it and keeping it safe. You know, depending on the size of it, we heard when we got estimates from the Pentagon, upwards of tens of thousands of forces would need to be committed. And when those numbers started to be tossed out, that's when the decision started to get significantly more complicated for people that were advocating for a policy like that.
The Trump people seem to indicate that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, maybe because they were exempted from the travel ban, I don't know, have expressed a willingness to contribute in some way. Do you think we could actually realistically see a lot of Saudi and UAE troops on the ground in Syria to create a safe zone rather than a lot of U.S. troops?
So I think that would raise a couple of big questions. One is whether those troops who have never really done a mission anything like that before anywhere else in the world would be capable of executing it effectively. I'm not saying they couldn't, but I think it's really going to have to take a good hard look. And the second is whether the Syrian people in that part of the country would welcome the influx of troops like that from another country. Troops in these citizens in these countries, whether it's Iraq or Syria or anywhere else, don't always take kindly to the imposition of foreign forces on their territory. And I think it's an open question as to whether those troops would frankly be welcomed or whether that would create, you know, additional potential source of conflict and turmoil.
John Finer, who was Chief of Staff for Secretary of State John Kerry, and Washington Post correspondent Thomas Gibbons Neff. Thank you both so much for giving us so much time today. And while everybody else is focusing on he tweeted that, he bashed back this, we just spent about 40 minutes talking about the situations in Yemen and Afghanistan and Syria, and thank you for going into them with so much depth with us.
Thanks for having us.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue in a minute.